What if we could reimagine the traditional notion of a high flyer? Hey friends, welcome back, or welcome to the High Flyers podcast. For the curious ones, where we share diverse experiences in life, not just work, tune in and learn to fly high in your own way, from value creators and problem solvers at all aspects of society. Learn about their sunrise, magic moments, hustle, and so much more to help us all be 1% better every day together. And I'm your host, Vidit Agarwal.
I think the biggest difference, and this might be surprising, but I think the depth of relationships that I have with the people I work with every day is just so much deeper and more satisfying with my colleagues than I ever had in medicine. Which is really sad, because you think, again, watching the medical TV series and shows, you get this sort of impression that because medicine's tough and you see terrible things, you really band together. But the thing that most people don't realize is that you move around so much, like you're constantly in different locations. You've never working with the same team over a serious time scale.
That's Tom Kelly, and this is episode 52. Such a joy to speak to Tom, as he provides a unique perspective on the worlds of medicine and business. Hear about Tom's sunrise in Melbourne with Italian influences, including how his parents met at an Italian restaurant, his dad being a chef, and early memories of working in his family's restaurant business. We go into Tom's time working as a doctor, including his reflections on spending time in the public health system, and advice to future medical students. A moment that sealed the realization it's time to go all in on Oscar, the company that he's founder and CEO at, building the next step in clinical training. And if you have an idea and you're not quite sure how to turn it into a business, we spent 30 minutes on how Tom started the business Oscar whilst being a doctor, learning how to build a no-code platform, finding engineers to scale it, and then learning about investment and how VCs work through podcasts and online content, which eventually led to Blackbird investing in Oscar. Tom, welcome to the show, or should I call you Dr. Kelly?
Tom is fine. Hey, Vidit. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. No, we haven't had someone from a medical background on the show yet, so I've got a lot of stuff I want to cover with you. Now, let's start off with some quick facts to give the listener a bit of perspective on Tom. Where were you born and where do you live now?
Yeah, so I was born in Melbourne, Monash Hospital in Clayton, but I'm still in the eastern suburbs, so I live in Glen Iris, and yeah, grew up around that area pretty much my whole life.
And from a work perspective, what was your first job and what do you do now?
Yeah, so my first job, so before I was allowed to work, I worked at a wine store, like a wine warehouse where they had an online store, actually pretty innovative for the time. Like it was an early online store. And yeah, did lots of retail jobs during med school and all the way through to now. And nowadays I'm the CEO and founder at Oscar, where I am full time as of this year, a couple months ago. Loving it at Oscar.
Now, the name of the show is The High Flyers, and we talk a lot about reimagining a high flyer, right? Is there a high flyer in your life that perhaps hasn't got the recognition to date?
Yeah, I think so. Look, it's quite a hard thing. I think really for me, like my partner, my wife, Belle or Isabel, she's my high flyer, like supports me very deeply in a bunch of ways. It helps me be better at work, personally, and yeah, like she has like quite a different personality to me. Like she's very very confident, self-assured, not tentative in the way that she speaks, very clear. Like you never misunderstand Belle on email. And I think like we met in high school, like high school sweethearts, and we stayed together ever since. And pretty like I can really see parts of my personality and like my personal development that really were rooted from things that Belle pushed me pushed me to focus on. And I don't think we never have conversations. Like, she's my wife. She doesn't sit me down and say, like, these are your KPIs for the next few months. But like, over time, you know, there's all these things about couples sort of becoming more like one another. And I've become a lot tougher, a lot clearer in my communication and less, like, more self-assured, having this, like, self-belief. And a lot of the decisions I made in my career and, like, the path I've taken, I think was deeply influenced by the effect she had on me, feeling like, you know, I could take those risks and whether it's, you know, going full time for Oscar or even before that, spending a lot of time working for Frasers, the pre-medical business that I was a co-founder of. Bell really helped me through a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so important having a kind of partner who's almost a co-founder in your life, right? So
exactly,
super critical.
Exactly.
Now let's zoom out, Tom, and talk about your sunrise, your childhood and your early years. Tell me about you. You obviously spoke about being born in Melbourne here in Australia. What are your memories of your environment and the influence of family growing up?
Yeah, I had a really warm, supportive childhood. So my mum is Italian born. My dad was born in New Zealand, and they both moved to Australia as young kids and met each other at a restaurant that my mum's side of the family owned. It was an Italian restaurant called Trastevere, which is a really, like, trendy place in Rome to go out and eat. That restaurant was kind of like the hub of the family. So although my dad was not Italian, he was working as a chef and worked in mostly Italian restaurants. So he was sort of like a, you know, Italian, had an Italian heart. From pretty early age was, you know, behind the counter at, like, the bar and whether it was, like, serving coffees or doing, like, the cash register, like, those kinds of things were early experiences that I remember. I also have, like, memories of kind of everyone in my family working really hard, but also, like, struggling for money a lot, like, in the restaurant. Because when I was, so there was a pre-Tom and then during Tom kind of era of the restaurant. Right. So pre me being born, I think it was, like, really the heyday of the restaurant, like, kind of the, like, mid 80s through to the mid 90s. There was, like, really successful. And then during my early life, I think Crown opened and a few other kind of ritzy places. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of, like, the customers sort of slowly went downhill until it eventually closed. I just remember, like, lots of talk about whether it's, like, mortgages, mortgaging the house, like, dad ended up taking other jobs and things like that. So I was always, like, deeply supported and, like, always felt like my parents really focused on the right things with me. Like, I was always someone who was, you know, I loved, like, learning, and mum was always pushing me with, like, maths or English or reading and, like, trying to push me ahead of maybe where I was meant to be up to. But at the same time, yeah, I had this really early kind of, not quite trial by fire, like, it wasn't that bad, but I had a good sense for how it is to be an entrepreneur or running your own business, even if it's just a small business, like a restaurant, and how hard that can be and how much work you have to put in to survive.
Kind of like entrepreneur before entrepreneur became trendy, right? Like, it was
exactly,
like, small business owner. Yeah,
like, they wouldn't, they definitely wouldn't have called themselves that. You know, just like good hardworking people. The other side of that was just, I think, being brought up with, like, you know, whether it's food and wine and coffee and all these kinds of things, again, before they were super trendy and, like, associated with Melbourne, I think really left an impact in me in the way that I work with others. Like, for me, like, that kind of family eating together, like, playing together, working hard together was something that I was exposed to really early on, and so I've always tried to embody in all the things that I do, because I feel like that nucleus of the kind of love and trust for each other always pulls you through hard times, which I also saw. And the family, you know, no, kind of no matter how bad the business was, there were fights and things, but that nucleus will pull you through. Whereas if you don't have those relationships, it's just way too tough to survive. Yeah.
Mm. And did you have any heroes growing up? Did you have any posters on the wall or people in your direct kind of environment that you looked up to?
Yeah, I loved basketball, like, from an early age. My because my dad's really tall, so he's, I think, 6 foot 11, like almost 7 foot.
Oh, wow. 6 foot 11.
Yeah, yeah. and so pretty early on, he'd been cooking, and like scouts from the AFL, like basketball teams, would come and ask him to play, and he would say like, no, I'm too busy cooking or something like that, which in retrospect he always regretted. So I think like from maybe 2 or 3, we had a basketball hoop at like full standard height at the house, and I was like, I would just keep on shooting and eventually like be able to hit the rim and eventually like could, you know, reliably shoot. So my heroes growing up were, I think initially Kobe was someone that I really identified with. Then later years, like LeBron, Kevin Durant, Ray Allen. I always liked basketball players that could shoot really well, because that's something that I really liked. Other heroes, yeah, I probably more in my like early late teens, I was like super into math, so I had a lot of kind of like super niche, like, you know, like I really liked Euler, I liked Descartes, like all these people that had these interesting problems and theorems and things, and like their stories. I always used to think of like, if I was picking like an all-star team of mathematicians, who would I pick? And they always had the most interesting stories, like these weird weird scenarios. Like there was one mathematician I've forgotten the name of, but was very young, like I think 16 or 17, solved a problem that had never been solved in like 210 years. Then because they solved the problem, thought that that person was a witch and imprisoned them. And then they escaped and died in a duel. So I thought that was a pretty cool, cool life. Solved like probably one of the hardest problems that had ever existed. And then just, you know, go off in flames, basically.
Basketball and maths, right? That's not a combination you hear of often.
I think basketball is pretty mathematical.
Yeah, it is. And Kobe, completely agree. I'm a huge Kobe fan, even now. Obviously, he's passed in the last few years, which is very sad, but fantastic person. I've still got a T-shirt back when Adidas used to sponsor the NBA. I think it might be 10 years old, that T-shirt, and it's sort of become mess, but yeah. I've still got it, and it's got the Kobe 24 on the back, the Bryant 24. So yeah. big Kobe fan and basketball fans, are great to hear. Now, and then tell me, when you got to say 16, 17, when you got some understanding of the world and yourself, what was success to you at that age? Like, what did you want to be in life?
Yeah, now? I think like in my head I had this view of what, so success definitely included like a lifestyle where I was never worried about being able to survive or make money. And I think at that time I hadn't like explicitly done like the Freudian psychoanalysis, like linking it back to my childhood experiences. And I still don't know if that's really where it came from, but at some point in my head, I was like, I just really want to have like a financially secure life and do something where, you know, kind of no matter what happens, I'll have that security. So for me, that meant like a profession of some kind. I always felt like commerce or business was maybe like a little bit too vague and nothing. And although it was appealing, I was never like, sort of didn't have that, the audacity to just go for it early on. So I was really focused on like engineering and medicine, because I thought that those were professions that kind of like, no matter what happens in the world, you always need engineers and doctors in some shape or form. And it matched up with my interests, like that, you know, deeply analytical mathsy side. And then also like an interest in just all the sciences, really, like chemistry, biology, that kind of thing. I eventually kind of landed on just doing like mathematics. Like I chose to do a Bachelor of Science, you know, did really well in school, but I never felt like I had to use my score as like currency or something. I just did what I wanted to do, which at the time was just general science, go into maths, kind of work it out, probably do engineering after.
And I must say, I've got a lot of appreciation for people that go down that science and medicine route, just the grunt work involved, right?
Yeah.
Like I studied a commerce degree, pretty standard. You do that for a few years and you get into the workforce and life just eventuates. You're not really on a time spectrum as such, because I think medicine, as you know better than most, you're on that time spectrum where you've got to do your 2 year stints in different places and do a regional stint as well. So super, super interesting. Yeah. And then obviously you went on, I think you studied at Monash from what I understand, and then you went on and did a doctor of medicine as well. Yeah. That's probably a good kind of transition into magic moments, Tom, which probably is a favorite part of the listeners, because it really gives a sense of the person and some of those moments that we don't hear about, some of those painful learnings that were painful in the moment but really good in hindsight, people you've met, journeys you've had. Is there a painful learning that stands out in your life, whether it's in life generally or work, that you learned a lot from?
Yeah, there's been a few really impactful moments. I think I want to tell you about two if I can. I think the first one that comes to mind was the decision, like the firm decision to actually do medicine. So that was back, yeah, you're right, at Monash. And like I'd been doing a lot of these math subjects. And then, you know, I was thinking like maybe I'll go down that Euler path, right? Like the solving hard problems behind the closed doors. And I had this moment of walking through an office in Monash University. All of my mentors and profs were all in single office rooms with a desk and usually like a chalkboard or something. And just like the whole day, they would just spend alone in an office, just thinking, it's like, you know, beautiful mind style, writing equations on the board, thinking about their problems. And for me, that was a painful realization, because I'd spent so much time studying and going in this direction and realizing that, man, like, I just don't want to spend my life this way. This is not my idea of success. I don't want to be working on problems that may or may not have any meaning for anyone in the world. So that pushed me towards, yeah, that utility focus. And that's why I went down the medicine path. Like, I had a lot of friends going that way, and I was, I had that experience and was like, yeah, you know, I don't want to do this. I think one of my superpowers is pulling together other people, being like an empath. I need to do something with more meaning. And that's really why med was something that I wanted to do. And then the second most painful moment was, I think ironically, pretty recently, was when I first became a surgical registrar, which for the non-medical people just means like when you're the most senior surgical doctor in a team that is regularly on site. So you're seeing people who come in with surgical issues, talking to the boss who might not always be there, or they might be operating, but they're not seeing every patient. So you're kind of the most senior junior doctor in the team.
And I think the word I heard you use on another podcast was the bitch.
The bitch. The bitch of the unit. Yeah, yeah. It's like you've got enough experience to manage the dearth of patients and admin and whatever else. I got that role, and then I just felt like kind of deflated, if anything. Like I'd been working towards that point for, I don't know, at least like 10 years by that point. So from the day I graduated high school, if you track back to like all of the study and things I'd done, it was almost 10 years. And in my head the whole time I was like, man, when I'm a surge reg, like this is going to be awesome. I'm going to be so cool. My ego is going to be like out of control. I'm going to be so important. And then when I finally got it, I just felt kind of like nothingness. I felt annoyed about like the situation that we were in, whether it was with COVID or the hospital, you know, feeling like a cog in a machine, not being able to really change the processes, and looking at another 10 years ahead of me to become a surgeon. And then most of those surgeons seemed, you know, burnt out and disappointed with their lives. And for me, that was like, you know, if I needed any more of a push to just like go all in and bet on myself with Oscar, that sealed the deal for me. So we were about a month away from launching the first product for students with Oscar. We've been working on it for a while. And I still had that feeling like, oh, I spent so much time. I'm so invested in med, like, you know, the sunk cost kind of fallacy, like, you know, but 10 years of time doing this. And then I still remember it was a patient that I knew needed surgery. I was trying to organize it. My boss was refusing to come in. The administrators were refusing to open the theaters because it was after hours. This patient's, you know, like in pain, upset at me because I can't make the system work. And at that point, I just thought, like, this isn't what I signed up for. Like, I signed up for the Grey's Anatomy style, like, heroic diagnostician, do the case, you know, save the day. In reality, the majority of my time was spent trying to make the hospital system function. And like all of that kind of bright-eyed creativity and interest that I had was being forced into like some super bureaucratic system that I had no influence over. Despite being on the face of it, like the most senior person within that system, I had no ability to influence how it operated. And so all those things combined with how much we were crushing it on the product side for Oscar, I was like, yep, I know what I got to do. Like, I'm just going to go all in, I'm going to like, you know, raise money and just like fly the coop, basically escape. And yeah, I think it's been the right decision.
Those two themes you touch on around kind of have been that follower when you were in the medical world and also biding your time is a common theme, right? But I think a lot of people outside the medical space don't quite relate to it. Like, I know for one, I've got a bunch of friends who do it and often they talk about it and I just can't get my head around it. Because in the business world, you kind of, it's more of a merit-based system, right? Where, yeah, sure, you can't become a director overnight, but you can move through and you can experience different parts of the role. Business, yeah. And as a graduate, often you get hands-on responsibility, right? Whereas as a medical graduate, you kind of often doing the grunt work and you're doing the admin, or you're the bitch, as you call it. What do you, I mean, there's a lot of listeners of this show that are young in their life and they might be listening to you and maybe they want to go down the medical path, mm-hmm. and they're listening to you and they're going, oh, if Tom gave it away, then maybe I shouldn't go down the medical path, right? Mm-hmm. What do you say to them? Like, what do you say to yourself in hindsight? Like, would you change what you did, or do you think the experiences gave you this understanding of yourself and the world?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. So I would definitely do it again, because I think it ticked a box for me around that financial security, that that utility to society, that I think no matter what happens, again, like, I'm still have that medical training, I'll still maintain my license, I still love patient care and I think I'm good at it, but I find that the system is not for me. I find it too frustrating. So I think I don't want to discourage anyone from doing medicine. Like, my previous company, one that I still advise for, Fraser's, like, I'm actively helping people get into medicine and I still think it's a fantastic, rewarding career for most people. I think it's a specific personality type like me that doesn't mesh well with this, like, the public health system in particular and the inefficiencies of it. You have to be the kind of person that is happy to go to work and do your work and not really care about the way that work happens, and also kind of just accept the model of care that you're handed. If you're like an entrepreneurial person or someone that likes to create your own processes or like innovate, if you see something that's inefficient, like, there are three, you know, you send an email, to send a fax, to send a letter, why don't we just send the letter? In the hospital system, you can't change that. Like, and you try to change it, and then all of the individual stakeholders, because it's a public system, usually have some self-protectionism. They don't want to relinquish their responsibility. They become gatekeepers for the functions that they serve because they're worried about their job security and all these kinds of things, which I get. But because of that, there's this enforcing function for more bureaucracy, more systems and processes that aren't necessary, because there's no profit motive that drives the hospital system to function in a optimal way in an open free market system. Now, I think public health is amazing and should remain, but it's just that without that like privatized incentive, it really makes it tough for someone who does have that like constant like wanting will to optimize the way that you work. There's this like constant cognitive dissonance where everything you do could be done more effectively, but you can't do it more effectively. So definitely do medicine if you want to do medicine. If you feel the calling, you feel the urge, you will never regret it. Being a doctor is an amazing training and it's a set of skills, like a utility knife that can be used in a bunch of ways, whether it's in business, whether it's in public health. There are a bunch of different career paths that are awesome, and you know, things that I would still be interested in if Oscar went belly up, you know. So shouldn't be listening to me taking my advice as a binary decision. It's a very deeply personal thing I'm happy to field emails at tom@oscar.ai. It's a personality type and a clash. And if you don't mesh with that public health system, then you'll either have to kind of suck it up and deal with that, which many people do, or look for other opportunities.
Now, there's a couple of parts we can go down with a few questions that I've got, but I think one of the things you touched on earlier was impact, right? And that's a big kind of enticing factor to go into medicine, because you can have an impact where you see a patient coming in and you help them become better in some facet, and it's measurable, right? Is there a project or a patient you worked on that's kind of your most memorable experience, or maybe the most toughest experience, but you learned the most from? Because I think it goes back to, again, the audience is not that medical background, and we kind of, back to what he said, right? We use TV shows as our kind of barometer into the medical world, but often it's not accurate. But can you paint a picture? Is there a moment or a period that was your favorite, or was your biggest learning period in all your time in medicine?
Yeah, definitely. There's been multiple patients. So I think one thing on the impact part of it, another real benefit of medicine is that the impact you have on society is so personal. You see the person that is going to feel better after you've helped them. That's something that's kind of irreplaceable. No matter what you do, you never quite get that same level of just direct, like, dopamine from helping someone. Whereas if you're an engineer and you fix some complicated problem, like, you feel the satisfaction, but you'll never see the end satisfaction of the person or that item or system that lives within a broader machine. So I think that that's something that is very special about medicine. And I think where I saw that the most was when I was an intern at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. I worked for 3 months in the acute medicine unit. So that's where patients who have a lot of different conditions, or maybe slightly complicated history, usually sort of 60 to 70 plus, starting to get on in age, probably still at home, but maybe starting to have a bit of a decline, struggling to manage things, would come in with some new acute problem. So maybe shortness of breath or fatigue, usually something quite general. And it was almost like a mechanic shop. Like, they come in and then you got to fix and optimize and get them back home and back to their lives. And there were many, many examples. Like, there was a patient, so I speak Spanish because Belle's half Chilean and all the grandparents speak Spanish. And so I'm like an adopted Chilean. Like, my dad was the adopted Italian. Nice. And so we had a couple of patients who were like Latin American or had a Spanish background. And I would be like the translator. And that was always so rewarding, because this person had just come into this environment, you know, couldn't hear sometimes, couldn't speak to anyone, couldn't describe the problems that they were having, you know, these foreign doctors just telling them what to do or how to walk or what medicines to take. And then again, like, being that person who's the only conduit for that person who's stuck in a scary place to tell someone about their symptoms, and my job to take that on and try and make them feel better in themselves, just that someone is taking care of them and knows them and feels them. That was super rewarding. For me, like, I had a lot of countertransference, which is like a psych term for, like, when you see people that look like your grandparents or your parents and you just feel that warmth for that person. So a lot of elderly grandparent, Italian or European grandparents who had put too much Parmesan on their pasta and ended up having an acute exacerbation of their heart failure. Because if you have too much salt, you get short of breath and you accumulate fluid. And he'd be like, Tom, I just like a Parmesan on my pasta. And you're like, oh, okay, I know. I understand. Like, when I'm your age, I'm probably going to put Parmesan on my pasta and end up in hospital. But just please, no more salt. Like, no more salt. So anyway, lots of these experiences where I just had this, like, this warmth and fun, and the team I worked with were amazing. That unit just was, like, laser focused on being efficient, optimal, getting people home as quickly as they could, all working with mostly juniors and very senior doctors. I really loved that. That was one of the only places I worked in medicine where I felt like every day I got there and I had, like, a clear goal, and everyone in that system was trying to hit that goal. And there weren't these perverse incentives or layers or barriers, because everyone was on the same mission: get these people home and get them to, you know, an optimal outcome. So I really loved that. It was super fun.
The Parmesan point actually reminds me of a good question that I'm keen to get asked, because you got this front row seat to see different people, bodies, minds, diseases, right? I kind of look at that and I go, would you have your own notebook of how to live a good life? Like, would you go, okay, this person had this diet, so that's why they're sick, or this person played this sport? Like, did you pick up any kind of secret, so to speak, from that you applied to your own life? That you go, oh, this person ate this diet, so that's why they're bad, or they were very stressed out, or they didn't look after their physical side of it? Like, are there one or two things that you've picked up that you've applied to your life through seeing other patients?
Yeah, I think so. It's almost like a rather than individual people, it's more of a population-based thing. So, you know, in those 3 months, I would see cohorts of people that had certain characteristics or lifestyles that ended them up in a certain state. And it's super biased, right? So, you know, you're only seeing the patients that end up in your care center. So there's all these biases. But I think a couple of things. One, just having regular exercise. It sounds so kind of lame, but I think it's that whole, like, if you don't use it, you lose it type of mentality. I saw 90-year-olds that were still doing all the things that they did. They had their garden. They would do the same kind of routine every day. They would drive to the shops. Those were the people that had the longevity, quality of life. The people who had a more kind of like lack of routine, I think, were often people that like either had bad habits or things went wrong in their lives. And it's a hard thing to quantify. But I think the way that I think about it, like as a principle from my experience in medicine, is in your life, you have to create a system of rules that you create to make you your best on your worst day. So for instance, if I always go to the gym on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, no matter how I feel on that Monday, it's just like ingrained into me after a couple of months of consistent working out and consistent routine, that is like the lifestyle I've adopted. And that is how you get the longevity, by having this kind of system of rules that helps you be better when you don't have the motivation or you lack the energy to do the thing that you know you should do. And the other thing I realized from all these experiences is that there is still an outside chance that something completely out of your control will ruin your life, and there's nothing you can do to avoid it, which makes you, again, prioritize like the moment, being grateful, enjoying your life in the time that you have, and being like slightly hedonistic. So if there's something you want to do and you have the resources to do it and it's not going to damage you in the long run, you should do it. I'm not talking about like cocaine. I'm talking about like there's a person that you want to ask out, like ask that person out, because there will be times where you get sick and you're just like down and out for 6 to 8 months and you will regret not having acted on those opportunities that are in front of you. And I try to adopt those two principles, have some structured like regime, like the way you buy food each week, all these like mundane things. If they're consistent and like have a set of safety nets and floors, and Bell really helps me with this, then you can really like structure your life in an effective way, so that you're optimizing for a good outcome in the long run. And then the second thing is, just, you know, enjoy your time up to your own limits while you can.
It's almost like the takeaway there is there shouldn't be any excuses, right? Like anyone can do that. You don't have to be a doctor. You don't have to be a smart scientist. Anyone can apply that, and I think the systems and routines is so critical, kind of turning off that lizard brain, just making it part of your routine so you don't even think about it. And I do the same thing with my gym. Actually, I've got certain days where, whether it's a good day or a bad day or whether the world's ending, I go to the gym. So it's kind of turning off that brain and just doing it. It's like brushing your teeth, and it's so important. Now let's talk about business, Tom, and obviously you alluded earlier, you're the founder and CEO of Oscar. And I know you've found a problem that you're trying to solve with Oscar. The question that I'm curious is, you found this problem. What were your first couple of steps to bring that to life? Like either even as simple as registering the business or starting it up, right? And the reason I ask is a lot of my friends in the medical space have no idea about business and they don't know where to start. And I think there's not many people like yourself who've made that transition from medicine to business, right? Because medicine, like you said earlier, is so specialized. You're so in your books. You're so focused on adding up 1 + 1 = 2. Whereas as you've seen in business, 1 + 1 is not always 2, and there's no real manual to a business life, right? What were those first couple of months like when you thought of this idea? What did you do? How did you bring it to life? And would you have any sort of actions for listeners that they can follow if they're medical students themselves or medical professionals?
Yeah, I think it's a good topic to talk about because it's something that I think, you know, no matter like how specialized your profession is, I think most people can get pretty far without having any traditional business training. So, I would say in, you know, early 2019, have the idea around Oscar, you know, trying to create tools to eliminate misdiagnosis. So the first thing that I did was I used like WordPress. So you can use these like no code or low code solutions. For those who don't know what no code or low code means, it just means like a tool that lets you build something without having to be like a coder or engineer. So, you know, an example of one would be Airtable, or you know, you can build WordPress websites or chatbot builders, or all these kinds of things exist where pretty much no matter what idea you have, you can probably build an MVP on some version of that no code system.
And I might just say MVP is just the initial product, right? A draft almost.
The minimum viable product, like the minimum function, or the minimum like product that does whatever you want it to do. So if you want to intake job applicants and then send them an email, like you can use that with it on Airtable. You create a form and then they'll put in the information, and you, without having to code, can create all of the downstream actions that happen after someone does something. So I found all of those platforms and tools really useful. I built that like version of what Oscar is today, and tested it out with a few of the potential customers. So for me, that was medical students. You know, showed them what I had. I butted them up that there were heaps of limitations, and this was like an early kind of concept. But I just wanted to get their overall feedback to sense if I was kind of like Marco Polo, like, am I in a direction that makes sense? Not so much like, will they buy this thing, but just, is this like an idea that has legs? So I did that, and students were like, yeah, I really like this like chatting to patients. The chat like really fucking sucks, but it's good. If the chat really worked, I would definitely buy this. I would definitely practice talking to patients just with software. Like I don't have to find a patient with some rare condition. I can just talk to this patient on the software. It's easier, more consistent, makes sense. But I don't know, Tom, if you can make the chat work, right? So that's usually what you need to get to. You need to get to some level of validation. You'll have a lot of things that will suck, but you just want to get to the point where you feel like that idea has legs. And I think I've noticed a lot of my medical colleagues will have a problem that they have in their own life or like their workflow, but they usually stay at the conceptual level for too long. So if you can't be pitching or like trying to find founders when you're still at that like super high level conceptual framework of like, if I had something that did why, I like that would be a big business. Because if you never try to do it yourself with tools that don't require any engineering, you'll never understand like why this thing doesn't exist already. So when I built that prototype, I realized that the chat was extremely difficult. Like this ability to do basically an open conversation with a patient, the reason that didn't exist was because the chat was really hard. And so I knew that if this was to become a business, that chat was going to be a deeply complicated technical problem that was going to require a lot of effort. And I would really encourage people to kind of ignore the business. There are hundreds.
Like you don't want to scare yourself, right? You just want to start.
Yeah. There are hundreds and thousands of people in the world that want to be your COO, CFO, CXO. That's usually what I say. The X can be whatever else. There are so many people that want to find a specialist who's like got a problem and they want to jump on and be your co-founder and support you. And for me, that's Waleed, right? So I do have some basic skills because I was fortunate to be interested in this and like get all the right experiences during med school. But if you have none of that, I would still believe that you will be able to find that person pretty easily. And if not, there's no mystery magic set of rules and laws that you will stuff up. Just don't worry about it. Ignore it. Because I remember feeling like, oh, I haven't registered the business. So that means I'm going to like get sued or something. None of this stuff actually matters. You at the point at which you want to legitimize yourself, you've probably going to have enough resources, or you've gotten to the point where you will try and find your CXO, or you will pay an accounting company firm to help you set up your entities, like your companies and structure and stuff. You don't need to know how to do like P&Ls before you even work out if you've got an idea or product that works. So I remember like that feeling early on, especially with Phrases, where I was, you know, just tutoring and like doing some marketing stuff, but just had no idea about anything like salary, BAS, like I just didn't know how anything worked. But I realize now in retrospect, it doesn't actually matter. It's more about like, can you build a product, or can you understand what people need in the world? And then can you take that concept to just any level of validation? And then at that point, you can probably find people to help you for free, right? Like there'll be business grads that want to jump on a project or intern for a small company. Like I set up Oscar the company without any like company name. We didn't trademark Oscar. Like we just started. And then that stuff will come when you have gotten to the point where you want to formalize it. Because before that, it's just a couple of people working on an idea and trying to make something happen. Yeah,
it's such an important point you emphasize there, is solve a problem first, like put all your attention on that, and the bells and whistles kind of secondary, right? It's so important. And how much time did you spend on it in the first 3-6 months, like when you were still working full time in the medical world, and this was a side hustle as such? Yeah. How many hours a week would you be spending on this?
So it's a good question. The good thing about medicine is, especially as a junior, often you'll have three days off a week. Or at least you'll have usually you have some portion of half days and other things. So I would usually spend like maybe 30 to 40 hours a week. Like it's basically a second full-time job. Early on, not that much. So like, you know, maybe weekends for a whole month, and then we built that prototype and we're like, okay, feel like I have enough evidence here, let's keep going. So like next steps are to find like a CTO and then find like some early funding and then keep on like just pushing the envelope forwards. I'd say roughly like 20-30 hours a week, something like that.
And this is all unpaid, right? So you weren't earning any money for this product initially. It was just kind of building on it, because I think that's important, right? Because I think people often focus on how to monetize something and they get distracted by that. So I think it's important to understand the grunt work is important. And it can take 6 months, if not even 12 months, right? Where you might not find that product market fit.
And this was with the context of me like running marketing for another like pretty, you know, like multi-million dollars of revenue a year company. Like I had all of the set of advantages that I could have, right? I'd used a lot of these tools. I knew how they all worked. I wasn't like starting from scratch. But if you were starting from scratch, this would, to get to prototype something, just like being realistic, it'll take a month or two to work out how to use Webflow or how to use like whatever service you're going to use. And then once you've worked that out, then it'll take you a month or two to build it, some time to test it. And you've got to find those people that are willing to test it, that you trust and believe. You just can't get paid for it. You can't raise money before doing that. You have to, with the different cap on, like, you know, I do sometimes thinking about doing some angel investing eventually. And if I saw people that were coming to me with just absolutely nothing, expecting to use my money to pay themselves to do something that I did without being paid, I just never fund them, right? It's just like a red flag. You have to be able to get to some level of idea, even just idea validation, like just some proof points for it to be fundable as a business.
And also I think the work validation, right? I think the shine kind of goes after 6 months. It's like, are you actually committed to doing this? Yeah. You find that so much in today's world we live in. People want to have a side hustle. And I always tell my friends, I'm like, can you do it for 6 months? Just persist. If you don't continue for 6 months, that means you don't have that commitment. The shine disappears after the first couple of weeks, right?
I was just going to say, yeah, there's a saying I have for like our engineering team, which is like, however long we think it's going to take, change the unit and add one. So if you think it's going to take 1 day, it's going to take 2 weeks. So like plus 2 days to weeks. If something's going to take a few months, then it's probably going to take 4 years. And I think like most of the people's perspective on business is that once I have a great product, like they will come. It doesn't actually work that way.
Yeah.
Like building business, getting people to buy stuff is tough. And it always takes, like the cases where a big business happens overnight is really rare and few and far between. And you have to have just spectacular product market fit, which means just like really good matching of your product to what people want in the world. And those moments are rare and really hard to find. And most businesses, another hard, painful moment for me was realizing like spectacularly failing with my marketing goals and like the KPIs and metrics I set were always like 2 or 3 years ahead of where we actually were. And I always thought there was some quick fix, but there wasn't. Like you just got to grind, build word of mouth. And that's really only the way products grow ultimately is word of mouth.
And you mentioned earlier that you initially started this on your own. Now you get to a point where you need to bring on expertise, right? And I know you brought on a part-time engineer, which I'm hoping you're comfortable talking about, because I from what I understand, it didn't quite work out. And you alluded to that earlier, where team is critical at a certain stage, right? So tell me about that in a quick summary. Like now you're at the second point where you've got a product, you've put your own heart and soul into it, and you go, okay, there's an opportunity with this, I can scale it, let's find someone. Two questions there. One, how do you find a part-time engineer? Because I've seen it myself, it is bloody hard in today's world, particularly to find someone you can trust and someone who fits in with your mission, right? And then two, when was that point that you felt you needed to bring someone on to help you?
Yeah, that's a good question. So yes, I might do them in reverse order. So I felt like I knew that I needed to bring someone in to help me with engineering once I got to the point where I couldn't improve the product myself anymore. Like there was nothing I could do. There wasn't nothing I could do. There was a 1 year of studying how to code and like natural language processing that I would have to do to get past a certain bottleneck. For me, that was, so I did the first prototype and then I did a second prototype, which like I coded elements and like really stretched like what I could actually do, and then tested with another group of students, and then like it was pretty crushing. I just got exactly the same feedback, like no progress on any metrics. They were just like, yeah, cool idea, chat sucks, like that was and I spent like months trying to improve it, and I knew objectively it had improved, but the perception from people using it was the same, or you know, it was so bad that they hadn't seen the progress in their mind. So at that point I knew, okay, 6 months of me doing like 20, 30 hours a week trying to make this happen has failed spectacularly. I need someone who has like built websites and done this for real. And that's where it goes to finding someone. So my suggestion for those types of or people who have an idea and looking for people to join them, you want to try to find people who don't have engineers or haven't done a Bachelor of Computer Science, because those people are too good for you.
That's important.
Yeah. Both in actual talent, because they've formally trained and they're going to want to work for like a software company or found their own business. And for them, there's too much risk for them to work on your project. You want to try to look for people who are studying engineering or coding as a side project or alongside something they're doing, or they're going to like all of these coding meetups and societies and they're liking pages on LinkedIn. But then if you look at their information, they're like got a comm degree or no degree or a diploma in something. And you can tell they're working their skills up, like doing projects on their own, trying to get to the point where they can land a formal engineering job. So that's where I had that prototype, and then Mike, fairly fortunate because of my work where I was working during med school at Frasers and founding that business. And again, that's another suggestion, like before you're full-time or when you're a student, or if you are full-time, you just have to get involved with some existing established networks or businesses, whether that's communities, whether that's like moonlighting as an ops intern for some company, because that will give you a network of people. And within those networks, you'll find other connections. And it's one of those like things that you just have to like throw into the universe and just trust that like the time and effort you're going to put into this will pay off in some way. And it's not something you can measure or plan ahead of time. So for me at Frasers, we had this kickoff event. It was actually just down the road from where the Oscar office is in Melbourne in Fitzroy. It was a complete coincidence. And I basically pitched my prototype. I was like, this is what we've got. Like, this is, you know, I can see us having this big business, really like kind of as if it was a VC pitch. And then a couple of the med students in that network reached out to me and like, oh, this is really cool. Like, you know, I'm interested. I didn't even have an ask. I didn't say like, I want an engineer. I was just like, this is a cool thing. I need help. Like, if you're interested, just reach out. And then one of those guys was, had a background in doing programming and selling websites and like doing this kind of stuff. He wasn't an engineer, but he was super sharp, studying med, had that background. And I thought, well, I don't know if this guy will be my future CTO, but I do know that he is better than me and he can get this prototype to like, you know, 0.3, and then I'll be able to test at 0.3, like where we're up to. And when I was, you know, like when we were negotiating with each other and working out like how much of the business he would get us for this work and whether I would pay him or like ask Frasers to pay him and like take some of Oscar, like all of these negotiations about how we would split this imaginary pie. That's the calibration I had in my head. I was like, this person won't be my, you know, Steve Wozniak. Like he's not, like he wants to be a doctor. Like this eventually it's probably going to be a problem somewhere. But he can definitely get it to a point, this imaginary pretend problem product, to a point where I can get more feedback and then I'll have a better idea of whether this is legit and I'll be that much closer to being able to get to a fundable stage or enough proof to get more cash in the door to find the right person. And to be honest, it's 90% charisma, 5% luck, 5% skill. So it's all about trying to convince people that you are onto something and that, and for people to come on board with you and believe that you have something. It's always like that, just that, you know, that knack for people wanting to join you. And that's why I do think the successful founders just have, you know, something. Like there's just that like magnetism that I think you kind of know it when you see it. And if you are really struggling to be that person, then I would suggest finding founders and working for the people that have that magnetism, and you will learn the way that they do it. There's just no other way to do it.
Such valuable insights there. Now the other comment that you often hear from medical professionals and students is finance and economics, right? They go, if I'm going to start a business, I don't know, I didn't study accounting, I don't know how P&L works, I don't know what VC means, what's the stock market, what is cap table, all these things to scare themselves, right? Now you've obviously gone and you've got VC funding and you're now Blackbird, you're part of the Blackbird portfolio. Tell me about the step before that. Like as some of the listeners would know, you can be bootstrapped and you can sort of rely on your own cash flow or you can go out to the market. How did you decide, or if you even did, or did you just take a chance that you said you want VC funding? And two, I know you've spoken about the pitch process where you worked a night shift and then you presented. Did you spend any time educating yourself on the business model of VCs and how the money flow works? Because again, being a medical person, right, you're so focused on medicine. I doubt, maybe you did because your parents weren't in the business world. Maybe you had an understanding of finance and money. But if you didn't, how did you build that knowledge base before going to VCs?
Yeah, it's really, really good point. And I think it touches on that. Yeah, that kind of just deep uncertainty, like chasm of knowledge that I think a lot of people's ideas just die over. Like they just feel like they can't traverse this knowledge gap, especially for medical people. So first thing, you know, this is obvious, but like Google, YouTube are your friends. Like you'll find everything, you know, a lot of easy explainers of how different things work. I was fortunate in that I was really interested in this stuff for a long time. So, you know, like one of the inevitable career paths for a budding mathematician is investment banking. usually because they have no empathy, so it's perfect for them.
But you became a doctor, so you do have empathy, I hope. So.
It was not super foreign. Like it had an interest in it. There's a podcast I recommend, which is called The Pitch. It was a limited run by Gimlet, which is a podcasting studio that was acquired by Spotify. And I think they stopped doing it. But basically it's like Shark Tank, but the audio version, but it's less cheesy. So the people pitching have real startups. They're usually San Fran based. Some of them have gone on to huge outcomes. And I really got a good sense and set of instincts about how to answer questions and how to pitch from that experience. And lots of those episodes, you know, you see founders like flame out terribly or do a really good job, and started to pick up some insights there. And then, again, just have to thank Scott and the whole Frasers team, because from that work experience, there were just lots of small things that I had to take on that taught me about different parts of that financial system. When I first started running marketing, I had to plan a budget. So I had to spend some money on social media, work out how much money to spend, what result I was expecting, how that linked up to whether or not students would buy the programs or not. And then, you know, learn about things like ROI, like return on investment. So if I put in $100, how much do I get out? And those things you only learn by doing, or you find someone like a CXO or other person who's going to come in and be way better at that than you. So you don't have to do it, but you just have to acknowledge that there are a set of unknowns that you need some support with. And then in terms of the VC specific, funding, that kind of path, again, lots of resources, read TechCrunch or follow
And I should caveat there, even if you're a business student, that stuff is still new.
Agreed.
For me as being a commerce student and being in the business world, VC and funding and cap tables is still new. Just because you've studied accounting doesn't mean you understand it. And I think that's important to be aware of, right?
Yeah, I agree. And for me, it was all lots of podcasts and different sources. I really like the All In podcast. Highly recommend that one. Came up during COVID, but if you listen to that, it's all of the guys there are investors of some kind and different stages, and they usually talk.
Yeah, about often even founders. Yeah,
yeah, really, really useful to get a sense for it. But you know, broad strokes venture capital. It's a set of investors that use the type of money that is looking for a long-term investment. Family offices, a family that has a bunch of money that they don't want to spend and they want to invest in something, and because they're a family, they're not looking for their money back at any time in the next 10 years. Venture capital will take that money and find great companies, because imagine if you give 50 grand into a company, you're not going to get that money back unless that company becomes a share that you can buy, so publicly traded, or it gets bought for cash from another company or with shares. And so as a group of investors, they have that perspective. So they're looking for opportunities that have an outsized gain for a long time horizon. So because you don't have liquidity, because you can't get your money back, they want to find opportunities where you can make way more money because of that. And company investing and building is a really good place for that, because you can invest money at an early stage of a company that then becomes a $1 billion company. And obviously that becomes super valuable. So venture capital's perspective on everything is, what's that big outsized outcome? And then how much confidence do I have at any given stage that you're going to actually reach that outcome? And when you're really early on, they're betting on the person, the team, sometimes the product and the market. But if the product or the idea or the market that you have is so awesome, there's probably people already trying to attack it or do it already. So it's pretty rare that someone just has this out-of-the-box idea that had never existed. Like even things like Airbnb, Uber, they had existed before. It was just that for whatever reason, that team and that point in time managed to execute on the opportunity really well and create a big business. I learned just by watching others seeking it out. And at the point at which I was going to fundraise, obviously at that point I spent a lot more time like doing my research, trying to understand like what parts of the process were important, less important, where I felt like what hill I thought we would die on as to whether or not an investor would invest in us or not. And I thought pretty early on the two things that mattered were like the overall product vision and the market that they saw for that, and then me and the team as people, and like whether they felt like we were people that they wanted to bet on. And it's different for different stages, as like when we go to raise money in the future, they'll be looking at how we've progressed with the money that we had and how much closer we are to that big outcome. But early on, even pre-seed, sometimes they're looking just for that like raw talent, like the person, and believe that you're going to work it out. And I think of the VCs I spoke to, Blackbird were especially focused on the person, the idea, their connection and match to the problem. So the fact that I was deeply interested in a technical mathematical problem in medicine, and I'd had an experience of medicine that was subpar and wanted to impact that system, was really impactful with Blackbird. Whereas with other VCs, they just didn't care about that at all. And that was a strict like maths equation, and I just didn't check their boxes, and that's why they didn't fund us.
I think you've just given the toolkit any medical professional, any professional out there that wants to start a business. You've taken us through the journey. How do you start it? How do you find people? How do you get funding? So I think amazing insights. Probably the last one there before we go to final sprint is a question from our mutual friend, Nick Crocker, who is a VC at Blackbird. And he's curious, what's the biggest difference you found between being a surgeon to now being an entrepreneur?
I think the biggest difference, and this might be surprising, but I think the depth of relationships that I have with the people I work with every day is just so much deeper and more satisfying with my colleagues than I ever had in medicine, which is really sad because you think, mm-hmm. again, watching the medical TV series and shows, you get this sort of impression that because medicine's tough and you see terrible things, you really band together. But the thing that most people don't realize is that you move around so much, like you're constantly in different locations. You've never working with the same team over a serious time scale. And for me, someone who really loves, like I said, from my childhood, that family, you know, around the table, like the pasta from the restaurant after the restaurant's closed, like that kind of thing. I always found, I didn't actually realize it before now, but in retrospect, I realized there was that like deep dissatisfaction that the people I work so hard with every day, I had very superficial relationships with. It was always in the context of work or seeing a patient or increasing my output in some way, but it was very like hierarchical and never went beyond the surface. Now there were exceptions, right? There were some teams, particularly my vascular surgery team, if anyone are listening, that I loved so deeply and had like a really amazing experience with, but that was the edge case. They're the only team in my whole time in medicine that I would still like actively try and catch up with, or my trauma team as well. But like it's few and far between. Whereas now everyone in my team, and more as we hire more people, like I just have these people that I know so well, so deeply, you know, catching up every week, seeing the progress, the satisfaction of moving the needle as a group and a collective is something that you just don't get in medicine, because just at the point where you feel like you know each other really well, you're off to the next hospital or the next state or the next city. And I never realized until the last few months how painful and not satisfying that was.
Time for the final sprint, Tom. You mentioned basketball, so hopefully we can do 60-second timer shots here with each of these questions. Shot clocks, rather, I should say.
Yeah.
What's the best investment you've made in your life that is perhaps non-financial?
Non-financial. Okay, this is an early bet, but doing Pilates with my wife and mother-in-law is a scene. I'm putting my chips on that one. Like, I feel so much more agile and athletic than I did a few months ago. Other non-financial investment that I made was Audible. Audiobooks was a huge unlock for me, like just listening all the time. I think they're the main ones. Mm. Yeah.
One thing you want to learn in the next 6 months?
I want to learn how to teach other people to be better managers of their teams and how to kind of like scale the small startup, like my brain and the way I think about problems across lots of small teams that I won't have a day-to-day impact in. So how do I scale like the way I think about problems into a three-person group that's solving some important problem that I can't be in the room with them during that process? Yeah.
One person, a quote that inspires you?
This one's a little weird, but I like this one. A hero will let you die to save the world, but a villain will let the world die for you.
Yeah, right. Wow.
And the reason I like that is because sometimes you need to be the villain and they're not always the worst person.
That's a good one. That's got me thinking now. That's a good one. Nice. And last one, what's one thing you'd love to achieve in the next 12 months with Oscar?
I would absolutely love to, especially with the clinical product we're building, I would love to be in a situation where we give a GP who feels like they're not in control of their lives, you know, in a clinic somewhere, seeing their patients, I would love to be able to give them our software and they feel like a modern superstar, just like whether it's Pilot or Kin or Eucalyptus, they feel just as sexy and cool and as fun as them, and their patients have the same perception of them because they're using our software to treat their patients. That's the dream for me. I want GPs in Australia to feel sexy again, and to get the you know due satisfaction and recognition that they deserve for all the great things that they do. Yeah.
Exciting. Well, that's a good note to finish on. Thank you so much for coming on. You've seriously given us the toolkit for any medical professionals wanting to transition into business and be good at it. And thank you for answering my questions so graciously. You've really taken us through the steps. So wish you all the best and keep in touch.
No worries. Yeah, appreciate it, Vidit. That was great. See you guys.
I hope you took away some actionable insights and learnings from this conversation to apply to your lives and be 1% better every day. And I look forward to sharing the next episode with you next Tuesday. Stay tuned.